Hello and welcome back to Coffee with Conservationists, the podcast where I sit down with people who dedicate their lives to researching, protecting and documenting nature. I talk to them about issues affecting wildlife, the climate and global biodiversity. We cover diverse topics within ecology, biology, storytelling, activism and much more. My featured coffee today is Radical Roasters. I'll tell you a bit more at the end of the episode. Today I talk with climate activist and student guild president at Exeter University, Emma Desserum. We talk about the Shell Out campaign, the direct action group Just Stop Oil, and the many nuances within the conversation about no new oil and gas licenses. Hi Emma, thank you for coming on the podcast. It's really great to have you. I usually start these things with just the basic question of what, or your origin story almost, like how did you become interested in the climate or just generally nature and environmental issues?
Yeah, no, thank you for having me on. I think like a lot of people, it's quite like, I guess, a complex, like very non-linear kind of when I started getting involved with climate action. When I was younger, I was always kind of very in tune to kind of inequality and watching things like, you know, just like the classic like sports relief and comic relief and being like, this is really odd. Like, why is there this like big jazzy show about issues that are like so incredibly serious? And like, I would always kind of have to watch those and it would take me a long time to like process it and understand it. And, you know, being like, 8 years old and watching those kind of things, you felt obviously like incredibly powerless. And I did things like volunteering at school and stuff like that, but my kind of interest and like awareness about the climate emergency came quite a bit later. I studied it a little bit at school, like everyone did, but it was more of a let's watch David Attenborough and look at how tragic it is that the polar bears are losing their homes, but never kind of like connecting the dots to like social inequality and just like how bad the climate crisis is. So it was pretty much, when I went vegan when I was 17, I think that kind of made me connect a few more dots about, you know, animal agriculture and climate and everything. But it wasn't until I was around like 19, 20, so like 3 years ago, that I got involved in like actual like kind of activism and kind of really clearing myself up on the absolute mess that we're in at the moment. And also like another kind of bit of the messy story was I had a really bad eating disorder from the age of 17. And throughout like my recovery, I was always told like, oh, like once you get better, like you will have a great life and everything will be wonderful. So I spent about 2.5 years like recovering from anorexia. And then when I got better, when I got discharged, I started like just developing more as like a whole human. And like just like getting back into things that I enjoyed and like reading and stuff. And I read, I think one of the main kind of really big things that I did was read This Changes Everything by Naomi Klein. And I think that's quite like a classic book for a lot of like people in like the climate and environmental activism space. But I honestly like I put that down. I think, yeah, I was 19 when I read it. Because I'd been on like a few marches, like I did Fridays for Future a little bit, and I kind of got it and I got why we were marching and why we were like striking and stuff, but never like fully. But I put that book down and I was just like looking outside and I was like, why isn't everybody like out of their house like running, screaming and panicking in a way? But yeah, I'm waffling here. But it wasn't until when I was like 19, 20 that I got involved with like direct action. I'm doing stuff in like my local community, like just even getting like people litter picking and doing stuff like that. And then I've just kind of grown more and more and developed like my understanding of everything to the place where I'm at now, where I'm kind of like, when I'm not doing direct action, and kind of organizing and stuff, I feel like what, you know, yeah, I'm at the place now where I'm kind of like, it's direct action, or like, what else am I doing with my life?
Yeah, I mean, it's not really a point that we've ever discussed on the podcast, and it's thank you for sharing, because that's something that people don't really ever do, is talk about the human side of it and the development as, you know, climate activists and people today, like where we came from and why we do what we do. I get so many kind of stock responses that could have been, you know, obviously everyone's got an individual story, but there's so many that, without being mean to people, could have been copy and pasted from, you know, I loved nature as a child, I watched Blue Planet, and then I became more obsessed with it, and et cetera, et cetera. And I yeah, then took that into a career or a degree or whatever. And yeah, having someone like you talk about your own things that you've struggled with, and then turning that into a human connection with the wider environment, is ne never something we've done before. So thank you very much for that,
Yeah.
for your vulnerability and sharing. I think that leads us really nicely into what we're going to talk about, which is, or mostly what we're going to talk about, which is your campaigning and kind of the stuff you do now. With your work at Exeter, and generally your I'm assuming, because you're part of the student guild there, that you studied there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so with your studies as well, we're going to talk about the Shell Out campaign, which is huge. It's very cool, and it links in with a lot of work that I know gets done around fossil fuel companies being dropped by a lot of institutions and groups generally. So it links with some very relevant, topical, timely things as well, especially given recent news and some of the stuff people are doing at the minute, in the arts and culture world. But before we get into that, for people who are completely new to the podcast, because I do get occasionally, I have a kind of like an echo chamber bubble, but I do occasionally get people who are just like, what's going on? Why are these people so bad? What is Shell? What is Royal Dutch Shell? And why are they awful people?
Yeah, no,
I
of
mean,
course.
I know this, but like, what? Why? For people who have come to this from a complete point of a complete lack of knowledge on the subject.
Yeah, so Shell is the oil and gas company that is their main operations. We know that fossil fuels are the main cause of climate change. And Shell is continuing to invest in and actively like exploring for new fossil fuels. They are like one of the worst companies, like the biggest contributors to the climate crisis. You know, from when this all began with like the Industrial Revolution. They're also like, so there's obviously like the climate things that they've done, but also like social injustice and like racial injustice, because they have on several occasions completely like destroyed communities in the Niger Delta. They've committed essentially what is ecocide, although ecocide isn't in law yet. It's they've like intentionally and knowingly destroyed like communities and habitats there. And failed to kind of pick up the pieces. You know, they've left people there without like water, without homes, without crops to feed their children. And you can look more into that, especially Amnesty have done a lot of work because they also have actually like killed activists in Nigeria for trying to stand up against Shell. They actively like encouraged the government to threaten and use violence against activists trying to resist Shell's activities there. And on like the macro level, Shell has no intention of winding down its fossil fuel operations. despite the overwhelming consensus from the United Nations, from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and from the International Energy Agency saying that we cannot have any new fossil fuels if we want a livable climate for life. Yeah, Shell are investing on the last assessment by Global Witness. In the next 10 years, they're going to spend $46 billion on fossil fuels, while also making around the same amount, I think it was $32 billion in profits from literally destroying the planet. And the new chief executive has said that it's going to continue as an oil company in order to please its shareholders, essentially. And there's been so many reports into how awful Shell's greenwashing is, but there have been small successes. So recently the Advertising Standards Authority said that they had to get rid of a billboard and a few adverts which were greenwashy because they were just lies, essentially. So that is Shell. They are really, really bad. And you can do lots of Googles about that as well. But yeah, they're basically one of the biggest climate criminals and one of the worst fossil fuel companies that have led us to this mess. And the University of Exeter has been in a partnership with them for 15 years and have recently signed in November a new deal for 5 years to do research into carbon capture and nature-based solutions, which is just ridiculous, unproven technologies.
Yeah. So, yeah, for those, you said a lot of really good talking points there. So for those who want to learn more specifically, I wanted to briefly focus on the communities in the Niger Delta, so the Ogoni Nine, and their kind of sham trial around that, and the families still campaigning for justice in the international courts. That's something that I would recommend everyone to go and look into and find out more about. With kind of coming back to Exeter's deal, what does Shell contribute to the university? What do they, I mean, Shell are everywhere. Shell are insidiously everywhere. They're sponsored, they give money to arts institutions. I keep finding, I go to if I go into old charity shop, bookshops, you find nature guides sponsored by Shell a lot of the time, published by Shell, nature field guides, which I think is completely, and walking guides and stuff, which is completely at odds with obviously everything that they do and stand for. So what does Exeter get from Shell?
And also on that, I'm reading at the moment No Logo by Naomi Klein, another one, and I was reading it because it was talking about all of these massive corporations and how they've kind of integrated themselves into every corner of culture and society. And I thought this book was written, I was like, oh, maybe it was 2020 or something, and it was 1999, and I was just oh my goodness, this is none of it's new, but it was just so fascinating to see I guess a more historical account of Shell. But yeah, the university actually gets money, essentially. They get, for this latest partnership, it's £14 million for this research. And you know, the research on a surface level to an outsider, it's cool. It's about carbon sequestration in Brazil. But also it's we can't be legitimizing these oil and gas companies funding, new researchers to carry out research into solutions which are just so, in comparison to what we need to do, which is just to end fossil fuels and turn off the taps. It's I think Michaela Loach wrote about it in her book, It's Not That Radical, about this bath analogy, and if the bath is overflowing and the taps are still on and it's destroying everything, you don't come and get a bucket and try and get out the water while the taps are still on. You need to turn it off at the source before we do any of that sequestration. And by the university kind of partnering with them and legitimizing their greenwashing, essentially, it just allows them to have this social license to continue operating for even longer. So yeah, we're campaigning to get the university to cut ties. And we wouldn't be the first university to do that, because the University of Amsterdam recently came out saying that they're like cutting ties with Shell for the moment, because of student campaigning against it.
I mean, student campaigning has been an incredibly successful tool. You know, it's an incredible thing. So I'm fully confident that that can be achieved, your goals can be achieved. Where are you up to at the minute with everything? What's the status report on the campaign?
Yeah, so it's been very interesting. Also, like, existing at the moment, like, personally in this space where I'm both, like, an official elected representative of the students who has got access to the table. I've got a seat at the table, I guess, but your voice is never really taken seriously, to be totally honest, because you are the activist in the room, and it's like I'm up against so much. When I try and bring the campaign into these like official spaces, I mean, we've managed, like, through people power and through student power, to really draw attention to the fact that this is a problem, and I think that's a massive success in itself, to be honest. Like, especially when we're acting in such short time windows, like with the students, you know, having limited time at the university, in the space of, I guess, six months, we've, like, you know, had a lot of students interested in it. We've had a lot of, like, social media attention and pressure on the university to just kind of acknowledge that this is a problem. I mean, I've been in a bit of trouble for it, I won't lie, because of, like, pushing the boundaries, but you can't really expect you can't expect to make change without, like, a bit of friction. So I guess I see that as a success. But at the moment, we are kind of, like, working out what we're going to do at the start of next term. The biggest and most powerful tool that the university really have is delay and time and bureaucracy, to kind of, like, stifle student activism. But we have got to a stage now where the university is, like, reassessing how it makes partnerships. But there's definitely a lot more that needs to be done, because if we don't keep the pressure up, then they will just kind of, like, continue. But behind the scenes, I've been part of, like, a particular working group, which is, like, basically rewriting how they make partnerships, and having, like, small successes. But we definitely need, like, the next cohort of students to continue keeping the pressure up.
Can they go back on their deal if you put enough pressure, or can they cancel it, or have they been locked into this new 5-year contract? Have you read it?
So at the moment, like, this is one of the things that we're like advocating for them to include, is like a get out clause, because at the moment that money is paying for, like, new PhD like students to do this work. And what we're very much emphasizing throughout our whole campaign is, like, this idea of needing a just transition out of fossil fuel funding, because that's obviously, like, those ideas are replicated on, like, a macro scale when we're talking about a just transition to renewables and, like, workers and people coming with that transition. So we're very much, like, advocating that the university no longer partners with Shell in future and, like, signs no new contracts, because we acknowledge, like, the gap of funding for these, like, individuals, and the fact that if the contracts were just ended like abruptly without these people, like, without their livelihoods kind of acknowledged, and the fact that they are, like, relying on this money, and having, like, a just transition out of that funding. But at the same time, we're acknowledging that, like, the way up between, you know, a handful of researchers, while it's really important, versus, like, the future of humanity, and the fact that Shell is, like, actively doing things like by investing in fossil fuels and like continuing to produce so like, ridiculous amount of emissions, that is putting more people's lives at risk. So we're kind of saying to the university, like, we need a get out clause. Sorry, that was a really long winded way of saying like there needs to be like a get out clause in this contract. Obviously at the university is just like scared of making.
That's I understand that. It's just transition is needed in all areas of the industry, whether it's an oil rig worker or a PhD student, it's still someone who's affected by a loss of funding and a loss of income. So I do understand that. I think that a lot of people don't get why we need or why we need a just transition or what it is. I spoke to a friend of mine recently who overheard a union representative, like a trade union representative, argue against the loss of the oil and gas industry because he was like, what will happen to all our workers who are part of our union? You know, what will happen to them? So I think a just transition and creating more opportunities at a similar skill level in green industries is absolutely vital because these things can't just happen overnight. Because yeah, I find that often a lot of people who get into climate activism get into it from a place of quite high privilege and find themselves going, okay, so let's just stop it. Why can't we just stop it? And not understanding that that puts literally millions of people, well, probably billions, let's be realistic about the working class across the globe, out of work if you just stopped it overnight, and has huge ramifications. So I think that, yeah, that needs to be communicated a little more effectively, outside of our bubble, perhaps. I think it's less done so.
Yeah, no, 100%. I've been quite involved with like Unite, the trade union, over the last like year and a bit. So kind of being in those spaces, those like uncomfortable spaces, which I think is the most important place to be in doing this kind of work, because if we're just in our echo chamber, then we don't get like these like the opinion of like the majority of people. And we often talk about this like the need for transitioning to renewables and making sure that workers are like looked after on the way to like to that new like energy system. I think yeah, it is really easy to just be like, why like this very binary way of thinking of like why can't we just do it now? And like not acknowledging like the risks that come with that. But obviously we need to start this like sooner rather than later. And there's I think recently there was a bunch of like North Sea oil workers who went on strike, and they basically said like we need like training for the new like energy systems and everything. Yeah, at the end it will benefit everyone.
I've been trying to find a way to word this next question all week almost, because it's a really tricky topic. But I know you said you wanted to talk about your work with JSO, Just Stop Oil, who in the press recently, all climate activists in the press are vilified because the press is incredibly biased in this country. But in the press, they've been, yeah, heavily vilified, and even more so than XR, I'd say. Extinction Rebellion, for those who don't know, or who haven't seen the vilification of those groups. I've personally had a lot of issues with those groups in the past, mostly from personal experience, not from, not from kind of any major issues that I've heard, but mostly from personal experience of working with those groups. I've had a lot of issues with them. But they do obviously, their tactics are a certain type that gets on the news and gets people talking. In regards to when you were talking about just transition and looking after workers, do you think the tactics of blocking working class people from getting to work from jobs they could potentially be fired at if they're late too many times, is worth it.
Yeah, no, it is really hard, and like we wouldn't be taking this action like without a lot of thought and consideration. I'm sorry to hear that you didn't have like good experiences, and would be very happy to like talk about that as well, because I think it's really important that like all our movements are inclusive and like embody care and like what we want to see in a new version of the world, which isn't reliant on fossil fuels and money. But yeah, like it is a huge decision, and like I don't take it lightly. Like I've spent 2 weeks like slow marching with just a boy and blocking cars and blocking people going to work, who will be, on their way to work for that period of time. But the reason we're doing it is because we see no other option. Like when Just a Boil have gone to the oil tankers, and you saw like in April like 60,000 people with Extinction Rebellion doing like a peaceful protest. It got almost no media coverage and therefore no engagement from the government. But by creating this, I guess, tension and story, the media are like picking it up, and it is getting attention, and it is working. Because we are seeing all the major political parties, apart from the Conservatives, support the demand of no new oil, gas, and coal licenses. So it has been working because it has been in the news and it has been covered. Obviously, that does come at the expense of disrupting ordinary people. However, we are also ordinary people. Like a lot of people in Just Stop Oil are similarly on 0 hour contracts. Obviously there is like a lot of people who are also very privileged. We have, everyone from like lawyers, doctors, teachers, but mums, dads, brothers, sisters. And we don't take the decision lightly, but we know that the climate crisis is only going to get worse unless radical action is taken, and if the government doesn't stop licensing new fossil fuels, including, like the Rosebank oil field. The destruction and the devastation to ordinary people's lives will only get worse. So we see like the cost now is minor in comparison to what is going to only get worse. So yeah, I think it is like it's not something we want to have to do. We don't willingly like aggravate the general public. But we are doing it because we know that unless radical action is taken now, and people's lives and like the cost of living and people's health is only going to get worse. Like air pollution is one of the biggest like public health issues, and that's just accentuated by fossil fuels and this
Yeah,
horrible,
of course.
fossil fuel hellscape that we are currently living in.
Yeah, you mentioned that was a really good answer. And I'm glad that I'm asking you that question and not some like GMB news presenter or something. With regards to, you mentioned you did some work with Unite, which obviously is probably one of the trade unions that most people know, but obviously there's a lot of bigger ones. Things like RMT and ASLEF have been in the news for the rail strikes and et cetera, teachers union, universities unions, et cetera. What have you spoken to trade union representatives about how they feel about climate action and tactics that groups use? Because obviously there are a lot of other tactics that people use, indirect action.
Yeah, no, a little bit. And I think, I guess, like what we're up against is literally like the way the economy is currently working. It's, I guess, quite huge in comparison, I guess, to targeting a particular institution.
Yeah, of
Although,
course,
like,
much wider level.
yeah, and it's all like it works together, right? Like an ecosystem. And I guess JSO operates at the very radical end of like tactics, and it all kind of works together. And there's this whole idea of like the radical flank effect, like a recent study by the Social Change Lab about how as JSO has got more radical, I guess, more people are actually just getting involved and forming an opinion about how they think change should work. So that's really interesting. Sorry, what do you want? Oh, trade unions. Yeah, I guess there's not like a homogenous kind of opinion. I was actually speaking to someone yesterday from Fuel Poverty Action because they want me to come and talk to like their group and then also like the trade union like meeting in Exeter and talk about all this stuff. But I know that there's like one, well, there's one guy in our branch who really hates JSO, like he really hates Just Stop Oil. But there's others who are like supportive. So I guess it's like a conversation that needs to just be had more and more. But at the end of the day, like the role of the trade union is to protect and represent the workers. And workers aren't going to be protected unless we rapidly transition out of fossil fuels because it will impact their health like it will the whole population. And we can't, I think there's this idea that like the trade unions are protecting just their members, but that can't be at the expense of the whole of society and at the expense of, you know, like the collapse of the NHS and food shortages and the whole of society, just to protect their jobs for a certain amount of time. That might sound quite harsh, I guess, but in a way, like if trade unions are fulfilling their aims to protect their workers, then it needs to be long term. It can't just be about the next day. Like it needs to be this just transition thing. So yeah, it's there's not like a homogenous view. I think obviously like because of the nature of what a trade union is about, anything that's disrupting workers going to work and threatening putting food on the table is inherently like a bad thing, which I completely understand. But it's about this long term, and it's not even long term, it's like, you know, by 2030 we're gonna have, you know, loads of people displaced, even more thousands of people displaced because of the climate crisis. By 2050, it's estimated we're going to have 1 billion climate refugees. I hate that phrase, that people displaced because of people losing their homes, people losing everything that they love because of climate change.
Yeah, that's a really, really good answer. Because yeah, these are tough topics and slightly harsher topics to talk about sometimes. And they need a lot of nuance in the discussion around them. The meeting's about to end because, as I said before, I don't have the massive fancy version of Zoom. I just have the free one. So we don't have long left, I promise. I'm just gonna end the meeting here and then restart a new one for like maybe 10 minutes if that's okay. Cool. So yeah, we left it off because my Zoom cut us off at 40 minutes. But yeah, what I was saying before is thank you for explaining it in such a I guess it's a topic that deserves so much more nuance than I'd ever have time for on a podcast episode. So I think it's an important one to touch on, and I hope I didn't, seem like I was going in for the attack because I really, really wasn't. I just want to kind of give a wide view of it from my perspective. And my bad experiences with the movement and that side of thing are a very isolated incidents. They're not issues that I have with the wider movement at all. They're more, I think the next thing to ask is really kind of what's next. One of the last things we have to ask is for your work with, you feel in a position that you have to keep doing things. So with your work with JSA, but also just with the Shell Out campaign and your personal, all the amazing work you're doing, whether that's as an elected representative of the students, or as an activist yourself, what does the future hold?
Yeah, very good question. I think a lot of the time, like being doing this work, it's really hard to be resisting like the urgency culture, which I think is, you know, a very valid criticism of some, like from an outsider's perspective, I think is a criticism of like direct action sometimes. It's like, you know, there needs to be time to like think and and just to exist as a human, like build like meaningful relationships. But I mean, I've never really felt with like just a point where, like, I actually feel incredibly supported, and I feel like there's a lot of work being done to ensure that activists and ordinary just people taking action with Just Stop Oil are supported and aren't leading themselves to burnout through this work. And a lot of that is done through, like, you know, meditation sessions and like mindfulness and stuff like that. But yeah, on like a personal level, I guess, I mean, I've become the president apparently of the students' union in well, next week really. And I will be doing that role for a year. But alongside that, like, I will be continuing to do and integrate kind of the urgency of the climate crisis and the need for like institutions to be taking really serious action, whether that's breaking up with Shell or transitioning to plant-based food on campus, you know, as soon as possible, really. But a lot of my role is about empowering students. So I really want to spend this year doing more of that. I recently, well, actually yesterday, I had a meeting with a group of amazing students who want to set up a sustainability board to talk about things and for the university to consult on decisions like partnerships. So I'm really looking forward to kind of supporting them this year to do that, because I think that's an amazing accessible thing for students to do. So yeah, I think, you know, the next year I really want to be supporting students. I'm going to be continuing taking action with Just Stop Oil on my annual leave and everything. And yeah, I'm also applying to do a master's part-time from September in global sustainability solutions, because I think, like, you know, everything that I've learned is just through like self taught stuff, I guess, just like podcasts, books, websites, social media and stuff. But I really think that I have kind of like, I have just like a desire to take it to the next level, I guess. It's been like a long thought through thing, like, do I need to do a master's to kind of like prove that I know stuff? But I really want to do it because like the course looks amazing, and I think it will be really like fulfilling to kind of be learning from climate scientists and stuff, but also kind of recognizing that like climate science isn't everything. Like, this isn't a science problem, this is a people problem. It's a historical it's the result of inequality and like colonialism and a history of just everything. But I think doing like the science masters will be really good, because it means I can come out of the university knowing stuff. You know, and also I think that's a sign of hope to take on like a qualification like that. I think it's a sign that I want to kind of plan for my future.
I think a lot of that is, that's so important in today's age, where a lot of people have kind of, they've not given up, but they're kind of given up in their hearts. So, you know, they're taking action and they're doing loads of things, but they're kind of going, oh well, this is all for nothing at this point. We've, you know, not got many years left. Or, you know, there's that running joke that we won't retire because not because of the retirement age, but because climate change will kill us first. And I think that kills movements, that really. To have that hope for your future and to be saying, you know, no, I will do this and I will use it into the future and I will have this life and I will work as hard as I can for a livable future for me and my generation. It's a minority opinion nowadays.
No, definitely. And I think like I want to be able to use that to potentially like teach younger people. I'd love to do like, yeah, teach people about, you know, the world. And I think having like that just on my back will be really helpful to do that. Because like we talk about doing this for like future generations, but there's lots of things we need to be doing for future generations. So yeah, I just see it as like one aspect of my kind of duty at the moment.
Yeah. I think we were a little short on time, because my silly brain decided to double book an episode recording. So, unfortunately, we kind of have to come to a finish. But there's two quick questions that I want to ask you. The first one is seems completely irrelevant to this, but there's a purpose to it, which is because it's the kind of niche of my podcast, is how do you take your coffee?
Well, first thing in the morning, I have a black Americano, just like instant coffee, and then like a oat milk. But if I have it out, I will have an oat milk latte because, it's like one of my very few things that I spend money on, like at an independent coffee shop or just in the staff room, literally, just yeah. At the moment, it would be iced. I don't have a freezer though, so yeah, I'll be
That's
a lot more.
helpful.
Always in the independence though.
And lastly, where can people find you if they want to follow your work?
Emma Disarum on everything like Instagram, TikTok, Twitter.
Cool. Awesome. So thank you very much for being on the podcast. It's been really interesting to talk about something a little different than the traditional nature science side of things and have a bit more of a nuanced chat, even though it's only like 40 minutes is not enough time to squeeze all of this into one topic, but you've done it really well. And I think we've covered a lot of important things. So thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks again to Emma for taking the time to speak to me today. You can find links to her social media below. My featured coffee today is from Radical Roasters Coffee. This roaster trains marginalised people in the specialty coffee industry, is a small group of trusted importers, and is sold by a local cafe that I love and trust here in Falmouth. The link to their website will be, as ever, in the description. Thank you all so much for listening. I've been your host, George Steedman-Jones, and this is Coffee with Conservationists.